New Horizons is sponsored in part by the Idaho Humanities Council, deepening understanding of human experience by connecting people with ideas.
Today on New Horizons, Boise State biology professor and raptor expert Mark Béchard talking about his research at field sites around the world.
There are a variety of reasons why raptors are being threatened. It isn't just urbanization, it's our use of agricultural chemicals, our mining activities, all sorts of things are impacting raptors. When I first started, the bald eagle, the peregrine falcon, they were both on the endangered species list, and there was great concern they were going to disappear in the continental United States. What we're finding out is placement of these wind turbines is very crucial. You don't want to put wind turbines in corridors where large birds like raptors are migrating in big numbers.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. The sight of hawks and eagles soaring overhead or diving for prey can be awe-inspiring. But while these majestic birds may appear invulnerable, that's hardly the case. From being shot at by fish farmers to being poisoned by pesticides and felled by wind turbines, hawks, eagles, and other birds of prey face a host of threats in our increasingly urbanized world. Today's guest, raptor expert Mark Béchard, has traveled the globe conducting research on birds of prey. A veteran professor in Boise State's Department of Biological Sciences, Dr. Béchard helped establish Boise State's one-of-a-kind master's degree program in raptor biology, as well as the Idaho Bird Observatory, a university research unit that monitors migrating raptors and songbirds and provides education programs to the public. In addition to his field work in locations ranging from Kenya to Spain to right here in Idaho, Dr. Béchard teaches courses in raptor ecology, vertebrate natural history, and general ornithology. He is co-founder and director of Argentina's Center for the Study and Conservation of Birds of Prey and frequently publishes in leading international journals such as Field Ornithology, IBIS, and Wildlife Management. His research focuses on the habitat needs of birds of prey with the aim of helping to preserve biological diversity. Mark Béchard, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with an easy approach to this from my vantage point anyway. If you were to use a scale of 1 to 10 in identifying what risk factors there are for birds of prey today across the globe, How bad is it? How bad is this urbanization and all the other factors that I cited in that intro? What are we doing to these birds? How would you rank it, 1 to 10?
Well, I would certainly rate it as serious. I don't know if I would give it a 10, but for some species, it certainly is
close to it. Huh?
Close to it.
Yeah.
And there are a variety of reasons why raptors are being threatened. It isn't just urbanization, it's our use of agricultural chemicals, our mining activities, all sorts of things are impacting raptors.
I think the pedestrian understanding of this is, oh, well, we banned DDT and now we see eagles and hawks flying around, so everything's okay. It's a little more complicated than that.
Much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Because the use of pesticides is a global issue. Mm-hmm. And we might have some control over how pesticides are being used in the United States, but many raptors are threatened by pesticides that are being used in developing countries, and there are no regulations as to what can be used and what can't be used.
We're going to talk in a moment about some of your forays into some of these foreign countries, but just generally speaking, do you actually get involved when you go in to do research on a raptor? Do you then get involved with a government or with a non-government association in advocating for or successfully banning the use of something that is a particular problem for a bird of prey? Have you done that?
Very definitely.
Yeah.
That's a major emphasis of the research that I've been involved in, mm-hmm. is to get the governments of some of these countries, these developing countries, actively involved in wildlife management and get them to see that there are ways that they can remedy problems that mm-hmm. their wildlife are faced with.
So it's not just publishing in a journal, it's then taking what you've learned and marching off to the nation's capital or to the bureau or the government office where somebody could have control over this.
Very definitely. And, I mean, as an example, in Argentina, when we started doing the work in Argentina and found that there were huge numbers of Swainson's hawks being killed by the use of a pesticide. It was obvious something had to be done and had to be done quickly. And you do need to get to the heart of it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You need to get to the government agencies and speak with those people and try to get them to do something to fix the situation. Mm-hmm.
Our master's degree in raptor studies, I assume you're teaching in that program, of course, that's your program. you must then have in the curriculum somewhere not only the science, but something about how students do go about making the changes once you've discovered in your research a problem that exists.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. That's part of my raptor ecology class. We definitely have a management segment to it. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, we definitely try to get students exposed to how you go about remedying problems with mm-hmm. birds of prey.
While we're on that subject, and before we get to some of the countries you visited and done some research, give us a few examples of where you send the graduates of the master's degree in raptor studies. And maybe that's not exactly the accurate way of putting it. You're not necessarily sending them there, but they're getting great jobs across the world, I assume. Give us an example of what happens to your graduates, where they wind up.
Oh, gosh. Some of our graduates go on and receive PhDs at universities. We've had several of them. I suppose there's at least six or so that have gone on to get their PhDs, and several of those are teaching in universities right now. Mm-hmm. We also have a large number that get agency positions, work for either the federal government or state governments. One of our graduates is the non-game biologist for the state of Montana right now, for instance. So, I mean, there are a lot of them that get positions in wildlife capacities right here in the United States. But then we also have, you know, some international students that they go back to their home countries and they play a very important role in helping to develop wildlife management programs in their countries. Mm-hmm. We have an ex-student that I was just in Mongolia visiting, and he's really become quite successful. He's one of the top researchers in Mongolia right now, and working on managing saker falcons, which are used in the sport of falconry. And it's a big problem in Mongolia because people from the Middle East come and mm-hmm. harvest saker falcons, and they're trying to fix that so the population is not going to be mm-hmm. Threatened. But he's gone on to be quite successful in sure. Starting up that kind of work that has never existed in a country like Mongolia before.
And he is a native of Mongolia, came here to Boise State, got the degree, went back to contribute to his country.
Exactly.
That's a great story. Perfect example. Well, when I think of a raptor, I think of eagles, hawks, falcons, and vultures. Help us understand what those as initially educated as I am. What am I missing? Is that? I mean, obviously, there's all kinds of species. Okay, but help us understand the way you define the word raptor in trying to help people know and deal with the problems across the globe.
Well, if you go to the dictionary, the dictionary says a raptor is a bird with raptorial characteristics.
Just like Webster.
But by that, it means that they are birds that have strong grasping feet with well-developed talons. And they have hooked beaks, very sharpened mm-hmm. beaks that are designed to tear flesh and eat meat. Mm-hmm. So a raptor is a bird with those two basic characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So owls, eagles, right. hawks, harriers, mm-hmm. vultures are all technically yeah. raptors.
Now, I have to ask you this. This is kind of a personal thing because I just follow ospreys and eagles. When an osprey and an eagle goes for fish, does one dive and one use the talons?
Well, one is the osprey is the diver.
The osprey, he dives.
They actually plunge. They don't go in head first. They go in feet first. It's our only raptor that actually plunges its feet into the water to catch fish
and brings the fish up.
Oh yes,
with its talons.
Mm-hmm. Eagle it hunts by taking fish off the surface of the water. So they come in and they sort of drop their talons, but they'll take a fish that's right at the surface and they don't actually plunge.
I see. Okay,
and it probably is something related to the fact that their big size makes it difficult for them to get back out of the water again.
Well, I knew there was a difference. I just couldn't remember what it was, and it's a little more subtle of a difference than I thought it was.
But then the eagles sometimes steal the fish from the ospreys, yeah. which mm-hmm. has given the eagle a bad reputation down
right.
through the years.
Sure. So when you compare the size of the raptor population to that of the songbird population, and I'm thinking particularly of the Idaho Bird Observatory, where on one end of the property you have the raptors that are captured and examined, and then the other end is their songbirds, but I never really have thought about how many. I assume there's way fewer raptors than there
are
songbirds.
Correct. You are correct. Okay. There's something in the vicinity of 340 species of diurnal birds of prey. Mm-hmm. There's another probably 180 or 90 species of owls. So mm-hmm. altogether, there's somewhere in the ballpark of 500 species of mm-hmm. worldwide of, mm-hmm. of raptors. Mm-hmm. If you look at songbirds, there's something in the vicinity of 5,700 species mm-hmm. of songbirds. Mm-hmm. So there's 10 times the number of songbirds mm-hmm. that there are raptor species.
Mm-hmm. So usually when we talk about the extinction of a species, we're worried about how that upsets that delicate balance of the ecosystem. Birds of prey, of course, is at the very top of that list. What happens when a bird of prey goes extinct? What does that do? Maybe there's an example or two you could give of how that creates another problem. Push in on the balloon at one end and you got a problem at the other end. I assume there's countless examples like that in the ecosystem.
Well, I don't know if we have a lot of examples. We haven't had a lot of birds of prey going extinct, you know. Because they do capture a lot of attention, we've been able to take measures to help to prevent them from becoming extinct.
I guess I was thinking about what if they did. I mean, that you're obviously trying to protect
them. Well, obviously, if you lose the top predator in an ecosystem, that's going to upset the balance of everything.
Right.
The food pyramid is going to have to be restructured somehow. Mm-hmm. And either another species of some kind is going to come in and take that spot that's mm-hmm. been vacated by the raptor. Or, it's going to cause a total restructuring of the food pyramid.
Mm-hmm. How has the field changed since you got your PhD from Washington State a few years ago? Are we in more dire straits today than we were in those days? Or, like I said earlier, has the introduction of some of these bans make things better?
Well, I think in some ways we're better. Certainly in the United States, things have improved since I started. When I first started, the bald eagle, the peregrine falcon, they were both on the endangered species list, and there was great concern they were going to disappear in the continental United States. And now both of those species have been taken off the endangered species mm-hmm. list, and they no longer have any real protective status at all. So mm-hmm. When I first started out, when people were trying to develop research programs, we definitely were attracted to those species because mm-hmm. They had a lot of support, financial support, and there was a lot of interest in them. Mm-hmm. Right now in the United States, we don't have anywhere near as many endangered raptors as we did when mm-hmm. I first started out. Mm-hmm. But now, if you go outside the United States, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, we're just finding out there's a lot of problems in developing countries that are just now coming to the surface. I guess I shouldn't call India a developing country, but there's a serious problem in Pakistan and India right now with this analgesic that's used by veterinarians on cows.
Yeah.
It's because they treat cows differently than we do, that if a cow has swollen joints and it seems to be in pain, they give it an injection of diclofenac, and that alleviates the pain and the cow seems to be better. Ultimately the cow dies and it goes to the burial ground, and that's where the vultures have come traditionally to eat the cows. And what we're finding out is that diclofenac is extremely toxic to mm-hmm. vultures. It kills them within days. Mm-hmm. And, they're predicting that some of the species that exist in India and Pakistan, they're going to be extinct in 10 years or 20 years. Certainly in 20 years, they're not going to exist anymore simply because they can't tolerate that kind of mortality. It's a very political situation. It's not something that's easy to get people in the Pakistani government or in the Indian government to really listen to, because I suppose it's not one of the high priority items on their list of things to do, you know?
Yeah, you read the newspapers, you can figure out why that's the case, I guess. You're also the co-founder of Argentina's Center for the Study of Conservation of Birds of Prey. How did that happen, and under what sponsorship is this center? Is this affiliated with the university, or is it a government center?
It's affiliated with the University of La Pampa, which is a federally funded university.
I see.
And, well, when I first started going to Argentina to study Swainson's hawks, I made a lot of very good friends that had interests in trying to make a career of working with raptors. And a few of the people that I met were, you know, they had positions already, and I spoke with them and said, we really need to establish some kind of a research center where, you know, we can develop funded projects and have students go through these research programs and help to educate them in terms of, you know, how to go about doing research. So that's kind of how it got started. We went around and we interviewed different universities and to see who would be interested. And the University of La Pampa was very interested, primarily because it's the center of the wintering grounds for Swainson's hawks that come from the North American continent, and they're very interested in trying to sponsor, you know, future research projects looking at Swainson's hawks and better understanding their biology. So they put up some initial funds, facilities for, we have a research lab space, we have office space, we have a permanent faculty member who is my co-director that is there all the time, and well, we've got three PhD students right now that are working on raptor projects, and an additional four master's students.
What about our students in your program? Do they get down there to
research? No, we have not done that yet. Yeah. I'd certainly love to do that,
yeah.
But no, we haven't had that opportunity yet.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Boise State biology professor and raptor expert Mark Bichard. As you can tell, we're talking about raptor studies and some of the challenges across the globe. Kenya, you did take some students to Kenya.
I sure did.
Tell us about that experience.
Ah, that was a great experience.
Yeah.
It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience for a lot of students. It was a real pleasure to watch them just experience Kenya, the wildlife, the Kenyan culture. And I think if you talk to any of them, they'd say they'd do it again.
Mm-hmm. And what specifically were they charged with doing? What were you looking at?
Well, I was offering a class in ecology of African raptors.
Mm-hmm.
And I set this up with a colleague of mine that I've been working with. He's a Kenyan that lives in Nairobi. He's actually an employee of the Peregrine Fund here in Boise. Munir Varani is his name. And we hatched out this idea. And I said it'd be nice if we could get the students exposed to some research that's going on, and doing that, give them the opportunity to see raptors that are, you know, found in Kenya and whatnot, as well as experience other forms of wildlife that are mm-hmm. that are there as well. So we put together a class that kind of had two locations to it. We did a 3-day series of lectures and field trips at Lake Naivasha, which is about 50 kilometers from Nairobi. And it's a very controversial spot right now because it's the heart of the flower farm industry in Kenya. A lot of Dutch flower companies have moved into Kenya. It's just a prime place to raise roses and carnations and things like that. The temperature is perfect. Their greenhouses don't need to be heated at all. And Lake Naivasha is a perfect freshwater supply for the roses. But the problem is they produce all sorts of contaminants. They're using pesticides to, you know, in the greenhouses, and there's all sorts of fertilizers they're using and whatnot. And that water, they don't, you know, have the best sanitation in Kenya. So that water ends up right back in the lake.
Now, is that also a problem for birds of prey who use that lake?
Well, there's a species of raptor. It's the African fish eagle that it's in the same genus as our bald eagle is, and lives very similar But in large concentrations, there must be, I suppose, 250, 300 African fish eagles at Lake Naivasha. And the concern is that as the water quality degrades at Naivasha, the fish population is going to fall off. And when the fish population decreases, that's going to impact the fish eagles, let alone what is happening in terms of pesticide contamination that's coming up through the food chain, you know, and things like that. So we wanted to give students the opportunity to see what kind of problems wildlife like African fish eagles are experiencing in a country like Kenya. And then the second emphasis was to go to Masai Mara National Game Reserve, where we've got a project going where we're looking at home range and African vultures. And that work has never really been done very extensively because it's difficult work to do. These vultures have huge ranges. We're finding out they've got ranges that are, you know, like several thousand kilometers, square kilometers in size. So
just difficult finding nesting places and things like that?
But they just wander looking for food. They're scavengers, so they follow wildebeest, and that's their food supply. So where the wildebeest go, that's where the vultures have to go. And if you are a cliff nester and you go to Masai Mara National Park, there are no cliffs there, so that means you've got to go a long way to find your wildebeest and then go all the way back to your cliff nest, which could be several hundred miles away.
It's so interesting listening to your travels and the research you're doing on a global front. And then I think here you are at Boise State teaching summer school, teaching is tied down here in for an 8-week summer session or whatever it is.
5 weeks.
5 weeks. Okay. And it's like you could write a ticket, I gather, from your academic background, almost anywhere you wanted to go. But we have the Bird Observatory here. We have the Raptor Studies Masters here, which, thanks to you, we have it. We have the Morley Nelson Birds of Prey operation out across the valley. This must have something to do with the fact that this is quite the place to study raptors in itself, the Snake River Birds of Prey area. Am I on to something here that this attracts people like you and keeps us from having to compete with our friends who might want to steal you away?
Well, you know, I was teaching at Marshall University for 2 years back in the early 80s and trying to find a niche for myself in the world of biology. And I was quickly finding that being a raptor biologist was not all that easy to do in West Virginia or in the eastern United States. I was feeling a little bit frustrated, and one day I got a letter in the mail from an ex-graduate student colleague of mine, and he had clipped an advertisement out of Science Magazine, and it was the ad for my position here at Boise State. And he said, "You got to apply for this job." And I did. And of course, I mean, I couldn't pass that up. How could I not have applied for a job where I could have come to a place where there is a Birds of Prey natural conservation area? The Peregrine Fund is moving to Boise, and they're actively involved in raptor research. There's a university that wants to develop a program in raptor biology. I mean, it was a perfect fit for me. And, well, to be honest with you, I've been happy doing this ever since.
Sure.
Why would I want to go anyplace else?
Right. And a good amount of your research for a while there anyway, and I assume still is, has been on vultures, turkey vultures. What an interesting bird. I mean, clearly an ugly bird, but I still remember enough about turkey vultures to know that they have a bald head so they can dig in and get all that good stuff off the prey that has already passed on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that's all I know. So you're going to tell us the rest. Tell us about your research and what are the threats to the turkey vulture these days?
Okay. Well, my research really has more than one focus. One thing that, and it's just not me, I'm collaborating with a lot of people that I've known down through the years. And one of the things that we're trying to get a better handle on is just what are the daily movements of turkey vultures during their breeding season. And that's taken me to Saskatchewan, where I've been working with people for 30 years. Mm-hmm. I've been working up in Saskatchewan.
And they're moving north, is that?
In Saskatchewan, they didn't exist there 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But with climate change, they're moving northward. And the interesting thing about them there is there are no cliffs or there's no caves or you know, that's where a turkey vulture likes to go and do its nesting. It likes mm-hmm. to get into a very dark place. Mm-hmm. But they just don't have that available to them in Saskatchewan. So they're moving into these abandoned farmhouses. And we find them nesting up in the attics, down in the basements, in closets, in these old abandoned farmhouses. And, I mean, that's something that has just happened. It's just mm-hmm. begun to happen in the mm-hmm. past 10, 15 years. When they're in a farmhouse, you know, you can see the farmhouse and go and check it and see if there's a turkey vulture. Here, they've got a lot of opportunities to go into a cave, you know, in a cliff like along the Snake River or something mm-hmm. like that. And their nest sites are just much more difficult to find here in Idaho.
Give us an example. I mean, I always am amazed whenever I hear a hummingbird story of how far those little bitty guys travel. But now tell us, a turkey vulture is a big bird.
Yep.
So it's going to leave Idaho, and where's it going to wind up?
Most likely end up in Costa Rica, mm-hmm. Panama, someplace mm-hmm. like that. The ones we track from Saskatchewan go to Venezuela, and they spend it's amazing. They go to the exact same place every year and winter there. And then they come back to the exact same farmhouse in Saskatchewan and breed. And we've had birds that have repeated that route three yeah. times now.
Are these tagged or something?
They carry satellite radios so we can track them from space.
Unbelievable.
It's really fantastic. And one of the interesting things about these turkey vultures is they like to go to zoos in Venezuela. And what they do is they steal the food from the zoo animals. So the zoo people down there...
They don't call them vultures for nothing.
the people that run the zoos, you know, they're very frustrated over this because they go, where do these things come from? You know, every year we get these turkey vultures coming.
Yeah.
So we've started this tagging project mm-hmm. In Venezuela, and it is a simple thing to catch them. They mm-hmm. just open a cage, put a dead chicken on the inside, and the turkey vultures just walk in and they close the door and they've caught the turkey vultures. They've put on something in the vicinity of 350 wing tags on turkey vultures, and most of those come from Canada.
We've run out of time, but I have to throw in one last question that brings it all back to home, brings it back to Idaho. Idaho and other western states are really getting into wind energy, and the turbines are flying high. And raptors are at risk of collision with these wind turbines. You've done a little bit of research on this, I believe, and I'm just wondering if you could share with us, what's the solution here? How can we help the raptors stay away from these huge turbines? Is there anything that can be done?
Certainly there's things that can be done. The problem is that the wind power industry is so new. And it has sort of a gold rush approach, mm-hmm. where they want to build these facilities now and don't want to wait for people to do research to try to indicate where problems are going to develop. So what we're looking at is wind farms going up, and we're looking at the aftermath of construction. And what we're finding out is, placement of these wind turbines is very crucial. You don't want to put wind turbines in corridors where large birds like raptors are migrating in big numbers. It wouldn't be a smart thing to put a turbine up at Lucky Peak, where we do get large numbers of raptors flying by, because you're just opening the door mm-hmm. for impact collision mm-hmm. problems. I've been doing work at the Rock of Gibraltar for several years, and the whole coastline in southern Spain is lined with turbines, and they've been doing that sort of thing in Spain for a long time, and they've learned that there are places where you just should not put turbines, and at ridge lines, at the point at the end of a ridge, those are places that generally attract raptors, and if you put a turbine there, there's a good chance it's going to develop into a collision
mm-hmm.
problem.
Mm-hmm. Mark Béchard, thank you for joining us today on New Horizons. This has been a great interview. Appreciate your good work, and good luck across the globe.
Thank you very much.
Next week, David Kirby, author of Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond, on New Horizons.